take just a couple of pieces of, I guess I can't say it's unsolicited advice since you're sitting here against your will.
Ish.
Or no, you drove on purpose. Just a couple of things to remember when people are going through sort of severe sufferings, in the sense of like, not just difficult situations, but severe issues. Just a couple of things to remember. One, you can see they're listed here. You cannot walk into a situation pretending you know what's going on. You just can't. It's not fair to them, it's not fair to God, in the sense of like, quit playing about your supposed understanding of God, what God is doing in the lives of God's people. It's presumptuous and arrogant to walk into that kind of situation like that. So don't, when you face situations, don't pretend you're more than you are. Right? Back to S-line. Okay. Don't think or try to short-circuit what God may be doing by fixing people.
This is where I had the question, like,
okay.
An hour ago.
And Steve, I haven't forgot about you either. You still have questions. And
just one.
Okay.
So, how...
If it's a
diacon... How do we balance this, yeah, especially in a diacon sense, with sort of the almost sarcastic or ironic, but the whole notion of, you know, saying to someone, God bless you, be in peace, you know, go in peace, but you leave them hungry and you leave them needy, you know.
There's a huge difference between showing compassion, which is what deacons do, and being a know-it-all. Walking into a situation, believing that you can fix people, and if they just listen to you and do what you say, they'll be okay. There's a huge difference between that.
Yeah, I guess, I think the way you've got it phrased does kind of poke me in some of the frustrations I've had before the beginning, just in general with stuff like that, where, okay, I guess as a deacon, this goes back to S-wine and stuff, you know, it's my job, like, somebody's in the deacon, it's probably financial trouble, or, you know, some sort of service trouble they need, and then it's, let's get them squared away. Right? I mean, is this... We should try... In a sense, we can't just say, well, you know, you lost your job, you're suffering, there's, you know, just gotta wait till you figure out what God's doing in that, versus there's gotta be some, maybe not rest, you know what I mean?
Yes. And the Bible says, help them.
Isn't it the deacon's job to ease suffering?
Yes. But that doesn't contradict the idea that my impulse is to fix people. Like, that's my job. And remember, we're talking about severe forms of suffering.
Yeah. Where it probably will be obvious that there's no way we can fix it.
Exactly. And not only that, but if you think that providing money or paying bills is fixing people, then you're not thinking about what diaconal ministry is, which is just showing mercy and showing the love of Christ inside of situations. There's a difference between thinking that I'm solving somebody's problems versus being an extension of God's love in somebody's life while they're suffering. Those are two different ways of viewing the same thing. Right? We'll get into that. I hope diaconal ministry makes more sense, or at least my vision of it, or what I think is going on, but in a little bit. Number three, be slow to speak and quick to listen. Right? That should be our modus operandi anyway, as somebody has quipped, God gave you two ears and one mouth to show his priorities.
Why do I feel like Brad should have said that?
Yeah. Did you say that? You know what I made that up?
I should have.
Yeah. Because our temptation is to speak. Our temptation is to manage rather than listen and understand. And I think good pastoral ministry isn't first speaking, it's listening. Because I think that's good relational maturity, not just pastoral maturity. It's just good relation, you know. If you want to be considered somebody's best friend, ask questions. And then listen. People think you're the best friend in the world. Mm-hmm. There's some truth to that, right? You're not a log. But there is some truth that most people just want someone to listen to them. Understand them.
It's not an abusive, I think sometimes you'll find you do become the best friend. I mean, yeah. It's not just here's how you can make them think you're the best friend.
Right, like, right. I'm not saying manipulate. Right. Thank you for that. And don't offer trite sentiments. Don't think hucking scripture verses around or spiritual counsel is helpful or even right. I know that sounds really strange to think that there may be an inappropriate way to use the Bible, but there is. I don't know if you guys have ever been on the opposite side of that. I have. In fact, this is one of the things inside of our Presbyterian conflict stuff that I've been going through, where I was on the other side of somebody who thought they knew what was going on, picked scripture verses. So the context is we had a meeting, and they didn't really tell us what the meeting was about, but as soon as he read the scripture verse, I'm like, I know exactly why we're here, and I'm not happy about it, because you think you know what's going on, based simply upon the verse that you chose to read. And it was the first time where I'm like, nope. There's something, and it's like, you think, well, how could it be wrong? It's the Bible. But it's the Bible in my hands, and the way that I'm using it, that cannot be right. Does that make sense? Don't think that just because you're armed with scripture verses, that you're right.
Like, judge not.
As a pastor, it's just made me more aware of the message you're communicating, not simply with what you're reading, but when you read it and the occasion for it and all that kind of stuff. And it can be manipulative to read certain passages of scripture with people.
Absolutely.
To open a meeting. You're trying to prejudice the outcome of it, unless you know exactly what's going on and you're like, I really think this is a verse you need to hear. That's not what I'm talking about. When people are grieving, Psalm 23 is a delight. You're not manipulating them when you remind them, look, the Lord is your shepherd. Right? He's good to you and he's good. There's nothing manipulative about that. There is manipulation when it's a difficult situation and you're trying to prejudice the outcome of a conversation or a meeting. Right? Here would be a great example. If you're struggling with somebody who's not listening to you, you probably shouldn't read, obey your elders and do what they tell you. Right? Hebrews 13:7. Probably not going to be a good idea. If you have to throw around your own weight in ministry, you're probably not doing a very good job. Right? If people don't hear you because they know you care about them and want what's best for them, or just because you're an elder, right? There's a huge difference between those two.
As someone who just gets to listen as a third party to what elders and deacons have to do, this seems like it would be a really difficult line to have to walk, like, in your ministry.
Right.
Like, it seems like it would be very difficult to know, okay, someone comes to me, they're suffering, I have this verse and I think I should read it to them, but is it going to sound like something you should just sew on a pillow and, like, be super saccharine to them, or is it going to be helpful and, you know, I don't.
Yeah.
Maybe it's more obvious when the time comes that whether or not it should, this particular verse, right? But it seems like it'd be difficult.
Sometimes people will even, like, both 3 and 4, like, slow to speak and quick to listen, don't offer, like, people sometimes, I'm assuming, will come to you and ask you questions.
Yes.
That maybe you shouldn't answer or ask for.
Yes.
Ask for sentiments, right? I mean, it's not that you interrupt them to interject, but maybe they do come and say, and it's still time to actually turn it around and just listen, rather than, even if they come to you asking, hey, can you talk at me? Maybe it's not right.
Right. Because they might be looking for an easy way out, at which time you're short-circuiting some of the things they just need to learn and hammer out, right? Yeah, that's good. Don't forget there are inconsolable things. right? S-Wine, I think his point is, and 2 Corinthians 12, there are simply some things Jesus doesn't want to fix. And you can't pretend that you can or want to or need to, or that's your job. That would be to go against Jesus, who is the actual shepherd, right? There are times in which God is simply not doing what you want to do or what they want him to do. You have to live with that in pastoral ministry. And you can't be angry with the people because it's not working out for them, right? The temptation is to get angry with them because, well, if you would just listen to me, or if you would just do this, that, or the other thing, right, then you're not really trusting the Lord.
Talking to Mike the other night, and he'd just been reading S1.
Yeah, right.
And we're talking about issues in the church that just don't go away, don't get fixed. He said that those are the elders inconsolable things. Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Can't fix it.
Like Mike.
Like Mike himself.
I can say that because he's not here.
So. I'll hear the audio.
That, but I didn't say it.
No, that's you shouldn't, because you've got to go back up there.
It's getting personal.
So the shallow response, it'll be okay. It'll all work itself out. Whatever. Those are things we tell our children. Like, they skin their knee, it'll be okay. Like, there's nothing shallow about that. The kid's screaming his eyes out, it's gonna be okay, right?
That's not what I tell Clive. I say, this may be an inconsolable thing, Clive.
Clive, this could be the end. He's all.
Wait, what?
Nux?
Clive. Thanks, Dad. You're a brick.
It probably just reveals that I'm a horrible parent, but sometimes you're just like, Toby, are you dying?
Yeah. Really?
Yes.
Let me just say, like, it with that statement, God's people are not children like our children. They're just not. And we don't treat them like children, which is just real trite and like, just get your act together, please. They're just not. Right? We don't want to be treated that way.
That's right. That's right.
And people don't want to be treated that way. Saying things like, oh, it's going to be okay, is just, what's the word, condescending, right? It's just, you're just telling them, look, your problems aren't as bad as you think they are.
Right. Right? May as well just watch a Hallmark movie or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Put your lipstick on, wear better clothes, and you'll be all right.
But if I understand what you were saying earlier, you don't necessarily need to try to explain the doctrine behind the fact that there are inconsolable things. Like, you don't need to be like, well, this may never heal or whatever. Like, in trying to not sound trite, you don't want to, like, bury them in the...
Right, exactly. Theology. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there are times when, you know, it may come... So think about a marriage, right? The sad truth is... You may have to come to somebody and say your relationship with your wife is never going to be what you think it's going to be. There's just too much damage and too, right? You're not saying it won't be, but you have to say, based upon what's happened in your marriage, you may now live with the reality that you may not experience the kind of marriage you thought you were going to have, and you still have to serve and love Jesus inside of that. You're basically admitting there's something inconsolable. This is I can't fix it, and you can't fix it, and we can pray and wait on God to do it, but He may not. What are you going to do then? That may be a reality.
So you should have to use wisdom,
yeah,
to know if someone needs to hear that.
Yeah, because if they say I can't follow Jesus because my wife doesn't da 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 da, really? Like seriously, your relationship with Jesus is based upon how good your marriage, right? That's the time in which you're like, no. Look, you acted this way, you did this, she did this, you guys have to live with the consequences of that. And you have to learn how to glorify God and trust Jesus and walk forward inside of a marriage that is not what it should be or could be. right? But most of us, like, it's we may not have the same problems as everybody, but is my relationship with Heather everything it could or should be? Because I'm not everything. Like, just one factor in that equation is wrong. It's me. I'm not who I should be or could be. Much less her. Much less the kids. Much less the stress and the pressures we all... Right? She has her own. I've got my own. That, but we all have to say, okay, it's not what it could be, it should be. How do I respond in that? That's just the way it is. But, and some people just may have a much more painful version of that reality.
In a sense, though, isn't there a way to say it will be okay when you both know that it might not? I mean, isn't that sometimes what people just need to hear? There's something, severe form of suffering. Isn't it okay? I mean, how... To sort of say it will be okay in a sense of just saying, I don't know.
Like God, like, works all things together.
Well, no, like in a smaller sense of just saying, hey, I'm here, I'm listening. It's...
Then say that.
Yeah.
Right? Like, don't play the game of like, well, it's going to be okay because I'm here. Just say,
well,
I'm here for you. Love you, care about you.
Yeah, not to say we're gonna fix this or anything, but just, I don't know.
We can face this together. That's what you're saying. It's gonna be okay means we're going to get through this together. But there is something demeaning about saying it's gonna be okay.
Well,
unless the time is right, like
how you say it. I mean, it seems like that might be the first thing somebody needs to hear when they're freaked out, stressed out, scared, right?
Right.
Like, even if...
Like to give them perspective?
No. Just, I don't know, just to say it, right? Like...
So I agree with you. In fact, there are times even with...
Maybe their spouse who's just been in a horrible accident, maybe he's not going to pull through, but they... Right? Like, you can't just be... Right? Like, you don't want to just be like, well, you know, I can't tell you it's going to be... Right? Like, isn't that the time just to say...
You're not guaranteeing the future.
Right.
You're applying...
Just to say it's
going to...
Like, yeah, I don't know.
That might be
so
a really extreme example.
It's almost the same words, but it's a different meaning.
So,
like,
so for instance, I wouldn't use it in that kind of an extreme example. Right?
Well,
that's pretty,
like,
pretty
I don't
gnarly.
Know what you do. But in an example where... There's a good chance that it may not be okay, that this may be an inconsolable thing, but just to say...
So when Heather and I are going through something, maybe she's overwhelmed by the week or the month or, you know,
yeah.
I have no problem just coming up to her and says, it's going to be okay, we'll get through this. And it's actually a helpful way of, like, just saying, like,
oh,
okay,
yeah.
I'm not by myself.
Yeah.
I'm not belittling her, and I'm not treating her like a child. I'm just saying, like, I'm acknowledging this is daunting, but this really is going to be okay because we're just going to take it one step at a time. Like, that's a different way, but in terms of, like, major issues, I would personally avoid that kind of thing because what you're trying to communicate is, the Lord is with us. I'm here. What can I do? How can I, you know what I mean? We're going to get through this together.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But I'm not in
yeah.
principle opposed to saying, you know, it's going to be okay. That's not what I'm saying. But there is a trite way of saying something like that. That's what I'm trying to avoid, where you're belittling somebody's problems and just sort of like, it's all right. It's just a skin on the knee.
Yeah.
Problems are not just skins on the, right? Some things are not.
You could almost say that's kind of how the world approaches it as well. You got this. It's okay.
Right.
And there's that's it. There's no hope. There's no identification. There's no we'll carry on together type of feeling. It's just a sentiment.
Sentiment, right.
That's all it is.
It's sentimentality.
And I'm like, well, how would you know, number one? And you know, I don't know. Yeah.
Something you said earlier about, you know, the husband and wife, you know, you've done so much damage that you may never get over this. I think it's important that you state the reality to them of what their damage is and what they've done to each other, but to always have the hope that, yeah, this may be a long, hard slog, but if you do bend your knee,
right,
and it may take years, but there's no guarantee. But if you bend your knee to Christ and start doing the things you know you need to do, God could bless you. God could
absolutely
recover this for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, and usually it means bending the knee to the other person in humility, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But it's the law of obedience.
Now, so I'm going to ask your question.
Oh, it was just on the usefulness of the cross. Mm-hmm. He seems to, if I'm understanding correctly, he in there is saying that suffering is not just something that Christ had to go through, but suffering is part of the identity of God. Did he say that?
So he, when he's talking about that, he's contradicting Martin Heidegger, who believed that part of God's identity is the suffering, becoming God through suffering. He's like, that's not what we're talking about. He would not affirm that suffering is part of the identity of God.
I just misunderstood it.
So let me see the article. So there is a section in which he quotes sort of New Testament studies. Misunderstandings can crop up at this point. In the last 10 or 15 years, nothing has been more intensive than suffering. In particular, Moltmann, The Theology of Hope is the crucified God in which the principle of pain, suffering, and abandonment is taken up into the very being, or rather the becoming of God, and structures relationships within the Trinity. Suffering, in Moltmann's view, first of all, is Trinitarian. If I read it correctly, it is increasingly clear that the theology of hope is not so much well. Is that the part you were talking about?
It's been a bit.
Okay.
I just got the... Well, my question was, maybe this will help you answer it better, that he was saying that, you know, God is a suffering God, and that's part of his literal identity, not just something you have to go through quickly and get out of again.
Oh, okay, so you're probably not thinking about that article then. You're probably thinking about Bauckham.
Oh, it could be.
Have you started reading God Crucified?
Yeah, I did. That is where it came from.
Yeah,
sorry.
So Bauckham, okay, so that's a totally different question. We're going to tackle Bauckham pretty hard. That's going to be our first serious theological reflections.
So well, my question was, if suffering was part of God, his identity, unchangeable, eternal identity, then what happens after the fullness of
Okay, the way, I would say, I don't think that's what Bauckham would say. I think Bauckham is also responding. In fact, he quotes Bauckham in there and his critique of Moltmann in that article, footnote 8, I think it was. But there is something Bauckham is trying to tap into, because the title of the article is The Crucified God, mm-hmm. which is a very provocative title and means something very particular, and we will get into that. And what he means by that is that what we see in Christ, so when Christ goes to the cross, right, so we have the humiliation of Christ, we've got the suffering of Christ, and then the cross of Christ. Bauckham is saying, we're not seeing somebody different than God. This is who God is. And so from the minute we meet God in Genesis, we ought to think of a God whose character leads him directly to there. That's different than saying suffering is inherently part of the divine nature. What it means is that God is inherently a giving and sacrificing God. And in relationship to sin, it necessarily leads right there. So that when Jesus says, he who has seen me has seen the Father, that's a powerful statement. That what he shows in the cross is truly who God really is.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's a little different than saying suffering is part of the divine nature. What it is saying is that God is inherently self-giving, even sacrificially. That is his character.
And in the absence of evil, you don't
he wouldn't
to deal
need
with suffering.
Exactly. Yeah. In that same way, no. Creation would be a good example. God humbles himself in creation in profound ways, but it doesn't include a cross. But how he humbles himself in creation is like, oh yeah, of course, that's going to lead him right to the cross. This is who he is, a self-giving God. Yeah, does that help a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
I hope so, because I think that article is profound in a lot of these ways, and we'll tackle that stuff.
It's a serious knot.
All right, any other thoughts about suffering?
We are like snails going through this class.
I really don't want to skip the next part, because the next part is like pastoral ministry 101, because it's trying to manage people's conflicts and sins, and this is basically relational sins, right? Husbands and wives and kids, and when we say things we shouldn't say and do things we shouldn't do, basically pastoral ministry is relational management, right? Getting people to respect each other and to speak in certain ways to each other and try to mitigate, you know, the effects of our sin. And but I'm going to skip it. You guys have the book. It's a great book. The four G's are excellent parameters for ourselves. Particularly, I think the first one. Like if you get number one, is it number one or number two?
Glorify God. What is God doing in this?
No, it's the second one. It's just like so hard, right? Because as somebody said, we have 20/20 vision for other people's problems and are blind to our own. If you can reverse those two things, your relational health and understanding is your light years away ahead of everybody else. If you simply acknowledge, I am as much of a problem in any relationship as anybody else is, right? In normal relationship, we're not talking about what we're going to talk about just a second, abuse. We're talking about just in normal relationships.
I can testify to that. I actually, in junior high, some parents who related to school came in and did. It wasn't resolving everyday conflict, but Ken Sandy has a, like a peacemaker.
Peacemakers, yep. This is a short version of Peacemakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and kind of did a peacemaker course for junior high class, and it seems funny almost in retrospect, but it did have a profound, like, I did not get along. I mean, I'm still not hearing people, but like, just that was very convicting. I think changed even just the rest of junior high and high school, just like, okay, even with the bullying or whatever kind of thing, like, look at you. Don't, you know, we always quick to judge, well, you're doing this wrong and this wrong, and here's how you're supposed to behave, rather than going, oh, it's, as far as it depends on me, what's my part in making peace here? And just the humility, I think, that goes on.
And that's the exact word, is relational humility, which is some awareness of myself, right?
Yeah.
So F, abuse, this is not, I don't believe this should go under resolving everyday conflicts, because I do think the word everyday is an important word in Ken Sandy's book. He's not talking about the systematic destruction of another person, which is what abuse is. Abuse is when one person feels that they are entitled to control, to use, to manipulate other people simply because they are better than everybody else. Not even for gain, but the inherent mentality of an abuser is, I am better than you, therefore I can do whatever I want. That's the inherent narcissism of an abusive relationship. And that it doesn't have to be physical abuse. Doesn't mean the husband is like, I'll show you how much better I am. Pow! That can be that, where you're not even worth me not punching or whatever, right? Usually it's not just physical abuse, it's primarily verbal and emotional abuse. I refuse to treat you like a human being. I'm not even going to talk to you. You don't deserve to be talked to for days. Days. Can you imagine? I've heard it. Because she didn't arrange his shirts correctly in the closet.
You told
her. We should have had like an over under, like how long poor Brad blows this whole thing up. You're like, wait till we get home. Actually, you're
if we even going home.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe you're not going home.
It's good we brought two cars.
We could have used three.
Terrible. You know, the truth of it is, we're probably all thinking about people who are like this. You know, I can see this couple. But the truth of it is, we all dabble in that at times. We all, we'll give her the silent treatment for a couple of hours. You know, or we can, we've all done this. You know, we're thinking, oh, I know a guy who's just like that. And God's saying, no, you can be just like this.
That it's a matter of degrees.
Yeah. You can be petty. Okay. You can be small.
Okay, so there is good. That's good perspective in the sense of, like, we all have an inherent narcissism where I am the center of the universe and everybody should serve me. Right. As a Christian, though, we're trying to combat that and say, no, I'm a servant, and so I will use my time and energy for the good of other people. That's not what we're talking about here. I don't want you to look at... And if you look at this and you see yourself, you seriously, we need to talk because you shouldn't be in this class. Yeah. Honestly. And I'm not saying, like, no, because we're not, none of us have these symptoms. It's not what I'm saying. But this systematic abuse and control and destruction, I mean, we're talking about
ongoing systematic.
People who hate other people at the deepest core of their being. And they may be the nicest Christian folk on the outside, but they are wretched on the inside. Right, and I have no problem saying there are wretched, wretched people that have no business being in our churches. That they have one goal, and that is to destroy other people. They're savage wolves, even though they look great. They're personable, charismatic, nice, but man behind closed doors, it is a totally different story, and they are so controlling that the family won't say a word because they're too terrified. Too afraid. That's what I'm talking about. If that's what your home life is like, you shouldn't be in here.
Have you run into that?
Oh, yes. Yes. We kicked the guy out of his house, flew up to Canada within days after the wife told us what was going on. Mm-hmm. Flew up to Canada, kicked the guy out of his house. You're not welcome here. I mean, it's the stuff. Who was I telling? Maybe it was you. It was you this morning over breakfast. I've been in a situation where people have clenched their fists at me, like they're ready to throw down. This was a situation where I clenched my fist because I wanted to reach across the table and punch that guy so hard. Stuff, I'm just like, you did what? You said what? No, he didn't deny it. Like, it wasn't even like, no, she's this, that, or that. It was like, no, yeah. Right? And you're just like, yeah. He's not in the church anymore.
What authority did you use to kick him out of his house? Didn't he resist that?
Well, we don't really have authority in the sense of, like, if he resisted.
You were bigger than he was.
No. Well, actually, he's not a big guy. No, ultimately, it's like either you listen to us or we're going to call the police. Like, you are a danger to your wife and kids. And the police wouldn't even think twice about this.
Oh, really?
Oh, they wouldn't even hesitate. They would walk in, and if she said half of what she said to us, there'd be a restraining order on the guy. The kids would testify. I mean, it wouldn't be even close, right? And she, it was a really interesting situation because we had known her for a long time and known the guy for a long time. And it was one of those things where in public, it's like just a great guy and super knowledgeable and organized and he read and he was, you know, but as soon as the veil was taken back, she got to trust us. That's what happened is she saw sort of the care that, and we weren't even living there. I mean, obviously this is Canada. 2 weeks after we called the pastor, the church planter, Larry Wilson, she was in his office. I can't take this anymore. And she's like, our previous church, the elders wouldn't have cared, wouldn't have known what to do, or wouldn't have believed me. And just in our minimal and the care that we gave, she was like, okay, this seems like a safe place to do it. And I'm not saying it turned out great. She's not doing particularly well. There's it causes, like, to tackle this kind of issue is a church-wide difficulty because people don't know what's going on, and so they take sides. What authority do you have to come into his house, right? Of course, he's not telling them what's going on. Oh, can you believe those guys coming up here? Typical American, right? The world police, right? There are sides taken, people have left, and like, what are you going to do? You just got to do what's right. You got to protect the people that need to be protected and deal with. If people don't have the patience or the foresight to understand, what are you supposed to do? Because you can't lay out the dirty laundry. You know how humiliating that would be for her? Hey, look what she went through for 17 years.
Well, if you put him out of the church,
we
excommunicated him.
We disciplined him, but we had to tell the church why we disciplined him.
Right.
But you don't air the laundry in the sense of like this
detail.
Is. Yeah, you couldn't give the details. That didn't go over really well, because he was so respected in the church. Right. He was one of those guys that was sort of like the poster child of what the church wanted to be. And next thing you know, we're like, he can't take communion, and this is why. And he may not be sitting with his family, and this is why. Wow. Yeah, in a Reformed church, they didn't like that.
Did he keep coming?
He did for a while. Wow. He left, I don't remember when. It's been a while since I've been on the session. Yeah, he kept coming for a while, and we thought we saw some good fruit, and like just kind of he could never grasp. He never, see, this is the problem with abusers, is they just cannot understand what the problem is. They just cannot, it's a beyond their ability to sympathize with other people. They just can't. There's whatever that is, they cannot grasp it. He could not put himself in her shoes. Just couldn't do it.
It's kind of a form of sociopathy.
Isn't it is. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about, hey, look, I see myself like I can be mean or rude or whatever. I mean, that's not what I'm talking about. We're talking about people who believe they have the right to do these things. They're in churches. Now, our what's nice about our church, if I can say, is we're small. People know each other. People who are predators come to our church and they don't see safety because there's nowhere to hide. Right? There's nowhere to hide in our church. Our church, it's like Colville. If somebody walked into Emmanuel, some predator who really wanted to prey on people, he'd walk right out because he'd be like, there's nowhere to hide. There's no foothold. There's nothing I can do.
Nobody's going to respond to it.
Or just he's really a sore, sticks out, right? Like a sore thumb, right?
But if you're abusing your wife and she's too terrified to tell and you look good on the outside, couldn't someone like that land in our church and it seems great for 17 years or whatever?
Yes. But even then, they realize that more people means I'm less noticed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right.
Pastor doesn't visit. Pastor doesn't really know me. Mm-hmm. I can control the church's involvement in my house, right? That's what they're looking for, is the ability to present things on the outside without letting anything in. Mm-hmm. It's a form of control. I control how often we go to church, when we go to church, and what their involvement in my family is. I broker all of that. In a small church, you have less success brokering that, right?
Yeah.
Controlling.
Obviously, an abused wife would feel like you're the kind of person, and the session is the kind of session where she can,
exactly.
She can come and say this.
Yeah,
that and safety that you were talking about.
Yeah, and so the abuser would be like, oh, gotta get out of here. Yeah, this isn't a good place for our
family.
Our family.
Yeah.
Right.
Not good for us.
I think there have been some that have come to our church and left. I think there are. I know this sounds really weird. I get really creepy vibes from people. Or I'm just like, there's something wrong. Something wrong between you and your wife. The wife can't look at you. Or you ask her a question and the husband answers. You're like, mm-hmm. Okay, there's something. Mm. There's just little things where you're like, okay, something wrong. And in the Reformed churches, some of this stuff is sort of justified with sort of this male dominance idea that I'm the head of my home. And what that ends up meaning is, don't you talk to my family without me. Or it's a form of control. And they use the Bible, right, which may or may not be a biblical idea, but it's at least posed as a biblical idea. That's a form of spiritual abuse then. So now you've emotionally abused your wife, and then you tell her she has to take it because she's the woman. And the Bible's on my side, and God is on my side. Now you've used the Bible to justify the fact that you feel you're better than others. The complications of that are just profound, because what is the wife supposed to think? Well, God says, or at least my husband says God says, right? And I want to follow Jesus, so I guess this is the way it should be. Right? I mean, the guilt and the complications of that kind of relationship are profound. But there are people who come to our church and I'm like, I hope you don't come back. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds horrible or whatever.
It doesn't. I mean, as a shepherd of sorts, you need to look out for the whole flock.
The guilt for me is, well, could I help inside of that situation, right? The other part of me is like, you're going to destroy this church, or you're going to introduce an element that is truly divisive and destructive, right? And it's come in different forms. Anyway,
you see that that's a pastoral temptation as well.
Absolutely. Totally. Mm-hmm.
Church.
Yeah, and we'll get there in just a second. Because I think I even have that coming.
Yeah, right? To a second dot.
Yeah.
Ecclesiastical, yeah.
The truth is, we don't want to believe this, but the quicker you just say, okay, because the Bible acknowledges there are people who want to destroy other people. The Bible's picture of human beings is not flattering. It's just not. And Paul is like, look, there are wolves that want to consume. The quicker you realize the church isn't just come on in, that there are protectors, that the church needs to be protected, the better we will be in just in, and we, but we can't be hard and cold and like, you know, but there is discernment, protection, and care for other people that force us to say and make those kinds of judgment calls.
I mean, we can't forget that the abuser does need Christ as well, but it's a very, how to say it, but in the meantime, I guess, and maybe even after, there's...
Yeah, of course, the... The question is if there's truly this kind of thing going on, what hope is there really? And I say this in the sense that the Bible talks about people that God gives over and brands their conscience so that they live without one. I think there are times in which our desire to show mercy and compassion and gospel truth perpetuates their continued ability to do what they do rather than just calling it for what it is. No person who has the Spirit of Christ in them acts this way. It's not possible. Right? It's hard for us to sit here and say that out loud. But do you really believe that somebody can systematically destroy another person and have the Spirit of Christ in them?
What about the idea that, like, the one thing that can soften the heart that's hardened and without Christ is the preaching of the word. It's like the one place where the person who is unhelpable could be helped is in church. You know, does
yeah.
that make sense?
Then you're weighing, then it's a matter of priorities.
Safety of your flock
versus the person.
One
absolutely.
Wolf who,
yep. With the supposed hope,
right?
When I have clear instruction, get the wolf out. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let them in and shepherd them. Does that make sense? I'm sorry, Gretchen.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I cut you off. In the case of the person who's already in the church, that's what the discipline process
exactly.
is meant to do.
Good.
Bring them to repentance,
right.
if they're open to it.
Exactly.
Right.
It's testing their faith.
And there really are two situations. It's one that's already in your flock that you have to deal with versus allowing someone to come in to your flock, right? Those are really two handled a little bit differently.
A little bit differently. Paul does say, though, wolves will arise from within your own midst. He gives both.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm warning you, people from the outside and from the inside. Mm-hmm. He's fully aware that not everybody that looks like a sheep is a sheep. He flat out just calls them wolves, savage wolves.
And yet by saying you are not welcome here implies that they are going to go somewhere else and be a wolf somewhere else.
Now, yeah, so say we have that situation, I would call that church in a heartbeat. I wouldn't hesitate to sabotage for the sake of that flock.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You need to know what this guy's doing in your church.
Mm.
Oh, I wouldn't hesitate in a minute. I would be irresponsible of me if, like, I'm just so concerned about our flock rather than the church, right? To say, hey, you're not welcome here, and then he just goes down the street. Oh, but, yeah, I'm glad you found a great place to worship, whatever. I think that would be disrespectful to the pastor, to the elders, and to the flock of that church. Now, they may not listen, and he may sell them a bill of goods like we're the problem. That, you know how often that happens?
All the time.
So now we, oh yeah, you're the ones that are controlling. He told us what happened. Really? Are you being serious? Right? And you just look at him. I'm like, okay, you can, whatever, be duped. But what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. If they're going to live on one person's version of the story in a situation like that, right? I guess you're going to get what you get, you know? What are you going to do? So,
well, it's up to the pastor of the church that he's going to discern.
Exactly.
Okay, they've been warned by you, now they need to engage this person.
Right, if they were responsible, they would say, hey, we've got this guy in our church, this is what he says about you, can you tell me your side of the story?
Right.
Do you think they take the time to do that?
Probably not.
Nope. So physical abuse is obviously, how do I say this? Is evident, right? Slapping, hitting, kicking, punching, or throwing things, right? If people use physical force as a means of intimidation, right? So say somebody kicks the TV in when they're in a fight or whatever. What message are they sending?
That could be you.
Yeah, that could be your face. Right?
Throwing a plate.
Right. It doesn't matter. And I'm not talking about, you know, that every once in a while you just come unhinged and freak out. I'm talking about somebody who's that fire burns inside and they're constantly intimidating their husband or wife.
Or they, like, use it as a tool to manipulate.
Absolutely. Get their way. Decisions, money, it doesn't matter. Anytime they feel like they need to assert themselves, they do, and that's how it comes. Isolation would be another form of physical abuse, where you limit your spouse's interactions with the outside world. Cut them off from their family, cut them off from their friends, cut them off from their... You just cut their world to the point where they are completely dependent upon you.
Good luck with that.
Hopefully with most wives, right? What are you talking about? You can't go see my mom. Sexual abuse is... there's two ways of saying this. So I broke it down into married. Right? Sorry to be a little uncomfortable. But there are spouses who force their spouse to have sex. It's like a form of marriage rape or whatever, where they don't care. No doesn't mean no. I've got needs, and you're going to take care of my needs, and that's all that matters. You know? Got to get my rocks off, and inside of a marriage, sex can still be used as a form of intimidation and abuse and of power inside of, right? And it's both parties are involved, where sexuality isn't a mutual enjoyment. It's a tool to be used to manipulate the other person. Or in having our spouse engaged in really humiliating... degrading behaviors. Again, you'd be shocked at the stuff I've heard. You just wouldn't believe it. You just can't. So adultery. Obviously, that's pretty... Is that abusive? At one level, yes, right? Because it's completely disrespectful and humiliating, and right? Then you've got sexual addictions, where a person just cannot control his sexual behavior. So it's everything from pornography to flirting online, right? I mean, the access that guys have and women now... is just unfathomable. So take it out of sort of our context, where you can establish relationships with women online, you can do pornography, all that. Think about the floozies, you know, when it's not all online, it's the guy who flirts at the bar, and all of that is a form of just out of control sexuality, which is humiliating to the other spouse. It's just not honoring and regarding holy. Like the book of Hebrews says, let the wedding bed be regarded holy. There's something that there's something set apart. That part of a relationship is not to be flaunted and used like outside of the home. And when it is, it can be a form of control over the other person. Look what I could do. Look who I could have. Right? I mean, I'm stuck with you, but look at all the women who, you know, I mean, again, you'd be surprised the kind of stuff that people are willing to do behind closed doors to sort of assert themselves over their spouse. Those are forms of abuse inside of a marriage. Right? I mean, it's hard for us to think, but that's outside of a marriage, of course, is everything from molestation to rape to child, all sorts of different stuff, right? Where you feel empowered over somebody else to violate that.
Pornography. World Magazine runs ads by a ministry or something. I just noticed them a number of times where the ad, it's, they must minister to people that are caught in pornography, and it says that 50% of Christian church-going men are involved in pornography. Is that possible?
I don't know how they do statistics. It wouldn't surprise me at all. Now, involved with is a very loose term.
Right.
Addicted would probably be less, right?
Right.
But involved with in terms of exposed to, available to, everything from cable channels to internet to phone. To, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Like watching Game of Thrones.
Or it, right.
Yeah.
That's considered some form of it, right? Do 50% of men in the church struggle with it? Probably not. Right?
Right.
Genuinely struggle with it. That I would guess the figure is probably a little bit less. But in terms of like exposed to, involved with.
Do you spend much of your pastoral time dealing with that issue?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things about this particular issue, which we could spend a lot of time talking about. There's an intense amount of shame and guilt that comes with, I think especially with men. They don't want to tell anybody. They don't tell their spouse. They don't tell their friends. They don't tell me. Having said that, there are people who do. And there's been a variety of sort of responses on my part, right? Everything from, okay, let's target what are the triggers, like real practical things, to let's meet every couple weeks and pray, to, you know, you just need the firm reproof real quick. You know, maybe somebody dabbled and, you know, it's not a problem. They just feel super guilty because maybe they were home alone and you know, it's three clicks and all of a sudden, you know, you do an advertisement and then that leaves and you're like, and, you know, and they feel guilty and they come to me or whatever. Depending on the issue or the severity of it, depends on the, but yeah, it's there. Yeah.
It's so debilitating.
Yeah,
it just crushes your spirit.
Right, especially addiction to it. It's all sorts of things.
Could you clarify just quickly what you meant by friends or relatives? You said outside of marriage, having sex with friends and relatives. Is that?
Oh yeah, so incest.
Okay.
Yeah, so you've got cousins preying on nieces and nephews, and in fact, they say, what is it, 75% of sexual molestation is family.
Okay.
Seriously?
Yeah. I mean, it's way higher than strangers.
Because they have access.
Because they have access, exactly. And nobody
worries.
Trust, that's the exact word, yeah. It may not be 75%, but it's considerably more than strangers, predators inside of your own family. And abuse victims will tell you, yeah, it was my uncle. It was my cousin, my older cousin, right? He was 16 and I was 8 or whatever. And nobody thinks about it. They're just playing in the back room or they're just playing video games or they're whatever. And next thing you know, it's happened for months and months or, you know, something like that. That's what I mean by people close to the family that have trust to be alone or to be put in situations. You know, we're much more protective of strangers. You don't let strangers in your house. Hey, come on in. We're going to go to the grocery store. You want to watch the kids? But you wouldn't hesitate. You know, Uncle Rob, you're not Rob, but, you know, whatever. Tim comes over, right?
Right.
There's no hesitation at all. For most of us, that's the way it is and should be, right? But the sad truth is it's there. And it's that's the percentage-wise, that's where it mostly comes from. Yeah. Yeah. I know we're all terrified now, aren't we? Mm-hmm. So emotional abuse. So this is everything from screaming and yelling and cursing out people, threatening, punishing. I don't know if you're aware of this, but husbands and wives punish each other.
Is it
like they're children? Punish them. I'm taking away your privilege of TV. I'm taking away the car keys. You don't have access to the bank account anymore.
Those are overt. I think there's more insidious, right?
Or yeah.
More partly, maybe even silent treatment.
Right.
That may be punishment too.
Think of silent treatment, not a time just to like I need to like. If I stay in this situation, I'm going to explode. There's always good times of separation and be like, I gotta get myself under control because I'm not in a good spot right now. By silent treatment, I mean days. What you're communicating is you're not even worth talking to.
Not just like normal passive aggression.
No.
Like a half hour, an hour where you're just like...
Yeah, please, right. Leave me alone. Yeah, not that. You're saying to the person... I'll talk to the dog. I'll talk to the kids. I'm not talking to you. You're not worth it. And of course, the implied is until you come and fall at my feet and make it right. And they learn that. They learn how long I can live without talking, right, inside of my own household. But can you imagine being, say, at a dinner table, right? And imagine this is happening where the husband is giving a silent treatment to his wife. He's talking to the kids. The mom starts talking. He doesn't acknowledge her. She'll ask a question. No. Just pretend she's not there. I'm telling you, it's out there. I've seen it, heard it. It's atrocious. You just can't even... I think abandonment is, I'm using this word in sort of a unique way. I think one form of abuse is you just pretend you're not really married. You go to work, you come home, you grab your six-pack, you watch TV, and you ignore the kids, you ignore the wife. Right? Weekends come, you get in your boat, you go out with your buddies, you go fishing, you do this. You're not really married. And the wife does her thing, manages the house, and you're, you know... Or the other way around, right? The wife is like, who knows? It's probably more men, right? Yeah. Don't really want to be married. Kind of stuck here. So I'm going to make the best out of this, which means I'm going to forget I'm married and I'm just going to do my own thing. I'll see you on Monday. Or late Sunday night, maybe. What time the kids go to bed, I'll be at home after that. So spiritual control is this is like bullying people from the pulpit, right? Where you teach messages and preach, where you have specific people in mind, and instead of actually addressing the people when you should in private, you just use the pulpit to do it. Those are forms of abuse because you're just using your position to manipulate and control other people. Right? Legalism is a form of abuse because you're controlling people's behavior by setting yourself up as the authoritative moral and ethical barometer for other people. That's all you're doing is you're saying, God tells you to do this. How do I know that? Because I'm telling you to do this. There's no freedom, there's no liberty, there's no... gray areas, it's I know what's right and wrong, and if you would do well, you would listen to him. That's a form, that's spiritual abuse. You're taking the place of God. And it, right? That's what you're doing. You're asserting control over other people. That's what you want. And so pastors can be the worst kind of abusers because it's a place of trust. It's a place of where there is sort of, in some sense, kind of an authoritative relationship, right? Well, if the pastor takes that and uses that for his own gain, he's crossed all his lines, right? He's crossed the boundaries. Because the people are kind of looking to him. So instead of leading them into faith, they lead them into legalism, right, or other forms. Pastors can be, or elders can be, demanding, just insisting that everybody does what they say. And they can be angry people. And the worst part is that they can control how other people see other people. Right? So say I get angry with somebody in the church. I could send out an email. Pray for so-and-so. Mm-hmm. They're really going through a tough time right now. I can sound all concerned and pastoral, but what am I doing? I'm prejudicing the whole situation.
It's slander.
It's slant, right? Because they're angry because I did something or whatever, but I can put it back on them, and they can't. There's nothing they can do. What are they supposed to do? Send out a second email? Pray for the pastor.
Reply all.
Just send.
He's controlling us.
Right? Who, for the most part, who are the people going to trust?
The pastor.
Right. For the most part, right. Except for maybe a few select people, and those are the people who usually end up leaving the church, right? Because they kind of see, they're like, there's something seriously wrong. And so you've got the sort of trickle, people trickle out. But the pastor gets to control how it looks and the information about those kinds of things. So that he looks good and, you know, and other people's, you know, behavior is questionable. Their character is good. Pray for them. So the truths about abuse are this. There are true victims. I do not believe that in every situation it takes two to tango. That does not account for this kind of situation. It does not take two to tango. There are perpetrators and there are victims. Genuinely. Where if a wife, say, up in Canada, when she came to us, if we had said something like, well, tell us what kind of wife you are. Right? It's over. It's over. You've lost her. She's gone. And she's gone in a place where now she's angry because she trusted and you just blew it up. Because the issue isn't what kind of a wife she is. It doesn't matter if she cooks the food to 165 degrees like he says he needed it, or if the shirts aren't arranged perfectly, that's not a her thing at all. At all. Right? Days of silent treatment is not, are you good? Are you really, really respecting your husband? Are you really submitting to him? He probably wouldn't do this if you really were really obedient to him.
So it's just because the, like, heinousness of what she was reporting that you wouldn't, it just doesn't even matter.
Nope. Nope. So here's an illustration, right? So say a husband and wife get in a fight and he just hauls off and socks her right in the face. And she staggers and, you know, gets her wits about her and cusses him out. So into that situation comes, you know, the pastor and the elders, right? What happened? He punched me in the face. Okay. There's this. Have you ever heard of the term moral equivalency? Mm-hmm. Okay, so in this particular situation, let's talk about what sin is, right? Sin is transgression against God's law. Sin is rejecting God's authority and his commands and character and all that kind of stuff, right? And I think most of us would put under that cursing, right, is a sin. You're cussing at somebody, yelling, screaming, raising your voice a lot. We would, most of us would say that just shows a lack of control for my own emotions, for the most part, and saying things that are intended to be hurtful. Okay, right. We would both say hitting, right? In this kind of situation, the fact that the husband hauls off and smacks his wife or whatever. But they are not equal in this situation.
That's right.
They're not. You don't go to the wife and say, did you curse him out after he punched you in the face? Do you have something to say to your husband now? Right? It doesn't matter how she responded in the sense the two are just not equivalent. This is simply a consequence of what is really going on, right? And it's the husband feels at liberty to punch his wife in the face.
Well, or even if it happened in the other order.
Or even if it, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you put a cross
through
that? Just in case.
Yeah. Oh, Jenny!
Pastor Mark said.
Facebook. Yeah.
Hey, look at our church. Instagram.
The only redeeming fact is that was there, too.
Right. With a cross.
With the arrow pointing to the person.
Another spiritual formation.
So horrible. Once you understand that these are equivalent,
yes. Oh my gosh. You have harmony in your home.
Well, let's do that. Oh my goodness. So you can't play the immoral equivalency game. In most situations, there may be a rank of like, what's really going on here? And what is sort of a residual consequence? You don't deal with the residual consequence. And you certainly don't attach to that sort of halvesies in the blame. Well, you know what, if you wouldn't curse your husband.
Right.
You can't lay equal blame on the table. Like, these are the things you need to work on, and those are the things you need. Now, there are times, so go back to that, the book, Resolving Everyday Conflict. Like, the whole log in the eye thing, for most relationships, is great. We would do well to say, look, that's me. Like, these are things I need, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done what. That's for everyday conflicts. It sounds like I'm contradicting that, but I'm not. I'm saying that in these situations, there is a perpetrator and a victim. And the Bible is just so clear. You defend the victim. You do not enable the perpetrator. If you turn the tables and say, well, what kind of a wife are you? You're just enabling his sense of moral superiority over, or even physical superiority over that person. So I'm not trying to contradict, but they're just not the same thing. So when I say, like, the whole setting is, what is the truth about divorce or abuse? The truth is there are real victims and real perpetrators. And the Bible is so abundantly clear, you do not defend the perpetrator. Some of the strongest language that the Bible has is against perpetrators. And some of the most tender language that the Bible has is for victims. Like, I have to have those categories in my mind. I have to. Because if I don't, I'm not going to understand, like, the scriptures and the way in which God is and his heart is towards those who are true victims.
What about men versus women in a marriage? You know, the stronger sex or something. Is there a greater burden on the man being the protector of the woman?
I'm just trying to think of some scripture verses. I think there is. I don't know.
Ephesians on marriage.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say a greater. Like, I'm called as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a pastor, as a friend, to walk in faith, hope, and love. women are called to do the exact same thing. It's just whatever situation God has them in, it just shows itself and manifests itself differently. I wouldn't say it's a greater burden. I think I don't personally buy into the idea that I'm going to show my cards here a little bit. There's this notion where the father is sort of like the priest and the king of his family, he's kind of the spiritual barometer of his household, and if he does well and he leads his family and his wife will be submissive and do what he says and he'll be strong and make all the good decisions and all that kind of stuff and his kids will fall in line. I don't buy that. I don't believe that's a biblical notion of what it means to be a father or a wife or a husband or that kind of. I think the textual sort of evidence for this sort of thing, I think it's just stretched beyond what I can bear. The way that they use the book of Genesis in particular.
You don't see at least a hint of like male headship both in the New Testament?
I have no problem acknowledging male headship, just simply because that language is used in the scriptures. It just seems
how would you define that then?
It just seems to me like that phrase headship gets so freighted that it becomes like this catch-all that any sense, any category of authority is invested to the husband, and every other category is then invested with the wife. In my mind, I think there's a couple of things that are just pressed too far. The analogy between Christ and the church, to a husband and wife. Just think for a second. I want you to think about the nature of the relationship between those two.
Gave himself up for the church. The husband gives himself up for the wife. I mean, it's the ultimate serving
situation. Now, that could be what Paul has in his mind, who loved the church and gave himself up for her, right? There, it's clearly the husband is called to literally give his life and his time and his energy for the sake of his family, right? Certainly, I don't have a problem with that. But there's an authoritative relationship between these two, an obedience relationship between these two, where Christ has authority and tells us what to do, and what do? Okay. Whatever you say, is that really where we want to take this analogy?
He's the literal king.
He's exactly right. And so some people say, well, let's talk about this relationship. You know, he's king. He's a priest. So I guess husbands and fathers must be the kings and priests. To me, that you're just taking it too far.
It's just that one aspect. He gave himself up for the church.
I think headship has a lot of different things, but I think that's like right at the top.
What I'm saying is I think that is the aspect of the relationship of Christ and the church.
Good.
That he's
from Ephesians 5
with husband and wife. Right.
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts about Ephesians 5. I mean, I preached through it. I taught it. I've studied it. I mean, I think Paul's doing a number of things there. I just don't think he's making an absolute blanket statement that the relationship that Christ has with it, which is exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
It just seems to go that direction where fathers and dads tend to be highlighted in a family as if everything begins and ends with them.
Right. It's an analog, not a direct comparison.
Yeah, I mean, there's some scary stuff coming out of that mentality. Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of that teaching, and I tried it. It didn't work too well.
You can see where the church would then be a fertile ground for certain kinds of abuse.
Yes.
Because of the abuse of male headship or the overinflated view of male headship, and also the trusting and ministering aspect would be more welcoming to anyone who would want to do harm in a church, because it's more welcoming and trusting than any other social group.
I'm going to say something that is going to get me in trouble if anybody listens to this. Deal with it, I guess. I think the Reformed Church attracts a certain kind of person as well. I think the Reformed Church attracts control freaks, because its doctrine is so tight and so exhaustive. It makes people feel like I've got a handle on God, I've got a handle on life, because theology, you know, like Brad, I know you were joking earlier, it's like I can get it all in a box. Well, that a certain kind of person gravitates towards that kind of thing. I have all the answers, right? I remove all mystery, and there's something about that. Well, you start, if my theology is this way, and this is the way I sort of approach God and life, I'm going to do the same thing as a husband, as a father. I'm just going to put the same boxes around it and want it just as neat and tidy as possible. Because that's who I am. I am a neat and tidy person. I'm a control freak. And I know I'm generalizing. I do think, though, that there is something about the Reformed Church that maybe even values this sort of ability to really control things. We just have to be on the lookout for it. Mm-hmm. Right? Whether it's from pastors or elders or people in the church. Church is messy. It's not a box that we live in. God is not manageable. We've been learning this. I don't know if you've noticed that. We've been learning this in Samuel. God refuses to be used by his people. He refuses to say, "That's me. I'm at your disposal." And we have to listen when God says, absolutely not. Under no circumstances do you use me. And I'm willing to do just about anything to prove you don't use me. I think Reformed theology can tend to be so clean and tight and so just perfect that it's like you just remove that reality. Like, God is going to do what God is going to do. And it doesn't matter what your theology is.
And it offers a lot of answers to questions and stuff, so I can totally see attraction, I guess.
Yeah, and keep in mind, I mean, I'm Reformed, so I'm not like, disparaging in itself. But there are there are other church traditions that attract different kinds of problems. Right, so you go to a church that doesn't really believe in church order or care or discipline or whatever, guess what people are going to go there?
They're going to wing it, right?
They're going to wing it. They're the guys that like live with their girlfriends and they're happy at church because nobody cares about that. So I'm not saying like we're the only ones with problems. I'm just saying that there's something to this, I think.
And I think what has attracted us is here's an anchor, and this has been driven in the ground. These are inviolate, and the rest we work out by faith around the outside. But that's having that reform anchor, I think, has been really attractive to us. These are inviolate standards.
Mm-hmm.
That's been attractive to us.
Yeah. I certainly have no problems having that anchors
anchor
and the authority of God's word. But if I think that I control God because I that, or other people, or traditions.
Or that's the it.
Yeah, that is God.
Yeah.
Theology is.
We've nailed it.
Got it. We're good. I have this C, and maybe this is just me prejudicing what in the future, I don't know. Unfortunately, as soon as you start talking about abuse, you're immediately talking about divorce and things, questions like that. What, so a husband abuses his wife? Like, is there any, does the wife have to just sit there and take it? Right? Or is there recourse? And what you'll find, I think, is a couple of statements that are, I think, are just really unfortunate. And one is Malachi 3, God hates divorce. That's not a very good translation, number one. Number two, the recognition that in cases like these, say a husband was physically and sexually abusing his wife, right, his own wife, it's not the wife's desire to divorce that terminates the marriage. It's the husband. It's not her. Like the idea that because she pursues some legal action against her husband, that somehow is detrimental to the marriage is just so backwards. But that's the guilt that gets laid. Like, if she pursues some form of, like, I can't live in this. Like, this is, for me and my kids, I've got to get out of here. The idea that she is threatening the marriage or somehow, destroying the marriage? No. Yeah. Absolutely
she
not.
She initiated the divorce. It wasn't him that initiated the divorce, so she is guilty.
So she's the guilty party. As if the divorce was more important and more sacred than his perpetual violation.
So she kind of goes back to that moral equivalent.
Exactly.
You say, well, divorce is wrong.
You want to... I'll tell you what's wrong, right? It's just, like, when it comes to divorce, and I think partly because it's so public... that the church just doesn't, it's like, bleh, it's like, ugh. And so now I got to answer uncomfortable questions, I got to write emails to the church and whatever, and how are we going to look if we grant this? And it's like, really? You're going to sit there and tell a wife, right?
And, I mean, even if you want to look at it from a church order legal, like from a legal perspective, I mean, you could, right? Like, isn't an unbelieving husband... I always use the wrong word, condoned or approved. Like, isn't that a reason a wife would divorce her husband if he's an unbeliever?
No, Paul says if an unbelieving spouse wants to leave, then let them go.
Okay.
If they look at you and they're like, look, we don't have anything in common anymore, I can't handle your Christianity.
Okay, it doesn't say a believing spouse could leave an unbelieving spouse.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
But still, back then it's... But it's still back to the moral.
So is it sort of like the abuser has destroyed the marriage?
Exactly.
It's no longer a marriage, so the wife is like making it legal.
Exactly.
Like,
just simply acknowledging what's true.
It's only a result of the destruction by the perpetrator.
Yeah.
Defending yourself.
Yeah.
And your kid.
So what you're faced with is... I don't know exactly. I've used this language of like competing moral and ethical injunctions by God. So here's God, and he speaks to us, right? Well, you have sort of competing. It's like this is what he says about marriage, and he wants us to be happy and healthy and loving and caring or whatever, right? That's what God wants. And then you've got God despises abuse, right? Just completely condemns it. Which is the higher ethical priority? God's complete distaste of this and the protection of the abused. So let's put that there. Or the supposed inviolability of that piece of paper. They're kind of competing, right? Because you're like, well, yeah, we should be married and God has like commands. Which one wins? Right, that's the question. But they're sort of competing, and you feel like, wow, we're put in a tough situation because God says this about marriage, but he says this about this, and you're like, what are we supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, those are gnarly, like, that's a gnarly situation to be put in. So we were put in that situation up in Canada, and we told her, she asked, she didn't say she was going to do it, she just asked, if this is a direction I want to go, is this okay? Will God let me divorce this man? And we didn't initiate. She asked us. They were separated. She asked us. And so we did our little thing, rewrote a report for her, and not a report in the sense of like, hey, 4 points, but like just response to her, met with her, and then gave her what we put in writing. And we said, yes, that you could divorce him, and if you wanted to, you could remarry. If in the future, she wasn't old. At the time, maybe, I don't know, 47, 48, 50 maybe, you know, something like that. Plenty of time, right, for careers and all that kind of stuff. But as soon as we did that, we had to tell the church. Because if she exercised that, oh boy, that was rough. Because they were like, you did what? Right? Because God hates divorce. How could you do that? How could you tell her that she's okay to do something that we know God says you shouldn't do? Right? But we had to make a choice.
Yes. Because they couldn't see all of the right-hand side of the whiteboard.
Exactly.
But the left-hand side is so visible.
Yeah.
Was that so? The church up...
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go
ahead.
The church up there or the church here?
Up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know
you.
Yeah.
I think even if it was okay to tell the whole congregation, yeah, I'm not saying it was, but even if the congregation had all that information, I would hazard a guess that there's still going to be some people
absolutely
saying,
oh, for sure.
That's still not.
So it's not a matter of lack of information.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. You're absolutely right.
So I realize we have the benefit of the wisdom of experience and stuff. I would almost say that the overall, in the broader scope, marriage is protected by kicking out the abuser in a broader scope, not necessarily in that specific.
Right. Yeah.
What you're saying as elders, you're saying this is how we value marriage, and this is what God is saying about marriage. Mm-hmm. But he also says protection of the abused means protecting also, you know, the broader idea of what,
totally.
I mean, God
yes.
is married to us and he protects us.
Yes.
And he, and, you yep. know, Jesus is, you know, he doesn't allow to consider that sacred.
That's great. Yeah. All right, heavy stuff, eh?
Oh, well.
What time is that? All right, so let's. Anybody need to go to the bathroom? Should we take another break real quick?
How long do you expect to have on?
One.
I'm looking to cut out.
Okay.
But this is.
This is the part where you're like, yeah.
Okay, if we got a second, I'm going to go grab a quick snack then.
Yep.
If now's a good time for a break?
Now is a good time, just for a quick break.
Thank you.
Yep.
I want to say I'm very